Welcome to Artists and Ancestors, a podcast where we explore ways to research and understand the past. Whether you're a local historian, genealogist, or just interested in learning about the everyday creative lives of people and the things that they made, this program is for you. I'm John Kay, your host of Artists and Ancestors. Hello and welcome to this episode 17 of Artists and Ancestors, the case of the photo detective. Now, Maureen Taylor, the photo detective, is a genealogist and photo researcher who helps folks unlock the mysteries from the past, from the PBS series Ancestors to the popular magazine Martha Stewart Living. This photo researcher has helped others recognize the importance of family photographs and has encouraged them to preserve and annotate them for their family collections. Maureen is the author of several practical books on photographic images and the histories that surround them. She writes articles for several popular magazines and is currently a contributing editor of Family Tree magazine. She has a couple of recent books. The latest came out actually the day after I did this interview with her. Finding the Civil War presents portraits and pictures from the Civil War era and encourages readers to discover their own family stories from this decisive moment in history. She's also working on a follow-up text to The Last Muster, a popular book that she wrote about folks who survived the Revolutionary War and the images of them. Let's go on into our interview with Maureen Taylor, the photo detective.
Hi, my name is Maureen Taylor. I'm known as the photo detective. And the reason I'm called the photo detective is because I study the details and evidence in a family photograph the way CSIs study crime scenes. And I'm telling photo stories and teaching history a picture at a time.
That's great. How did you get started doing that, Maureen?
Well, you know, someone just asked this question of me this morning, and it's one of those things, you know, that you always wanted to do, but you were sort of afraid to step out and do. I was a curator at a historical society, and I loved looking at photographs, and I spent a lot of time helping people do family history research. And I realized that no one was paying any attention to all the photos that were in the historical society. And I went on to other jobs, and I've had jobs as picture researchers for publishers and television and all that kind of thing as well. And I thought, well, what would happen if I just stepped outside the establishment and just started writing about photographs, which is what I really love, and writing about history and the history of photographs and the stories that are in the photographs. And this was back in 1995 or so when I really started to think about this seriously. I mean, I'd been doing this on the job for a long time, but I thought, what would happen if I stepped outside the establishment, as I said, and did it for myself and went independent? And it's been great. I mean, I've never looked back. I've never been happier with what I do. I love what I do. Every day is a new experience, and I learn something every single day.
I'm one of those people that's always really interested in family photographs, and then I'm always going to flea markets and antique stores, and I'm always surprised to find so many images that are orphaned out there, and it seems so sad that they're disconnected from their context and stuff. Can you tell me a little bit about how folks might think about their family images, and what should they be thinking about as far as passing down information associated with those?
Well, I think first off, people should think about their family photographs as important as other things that get passed down in the family, say grandmother's wedding dress or, you know, silver or furniture or jewelry. A photograph is a treasure just like all those other artifacts, and they really need to write some information on the back of them. We need to ask older members of the family or write down things that they've been told about the images. And it's very simple to do that. They use a very soft lead pencil on the back. And I encourage people, when they label these pictures, to also put their name and the date that they labeled the picture. so that in 50 years or 100 years, someone turns over the photograph and sees great aunt Mabel Smith, and they know that cousin so-and-so wrote that information in, 2011. So they know exactly who wrote it, and they can verify what a good source she was, or maybe she wasn't a good source, you know what I mean? What the relationship is between the people, how the captions on the back of photographs, if you have a caption. It's always questionable because you don't know who put it there, and you don't know when, and you don't know how knowledgeable they were. By putting your name as part of the caption at the end, that person who's looking at it can always say, oh, she was the family genealogist. It's more likely she knew what she was talking about.
I think that that's a good point. Is it's great to have as much data as possible and passing it down, but it's even more important to annotate where that data came from, because I don't know how many times I've found images that I knew were absolutely not marked correctly, or artifacts that were attributed to an era that they came from differently. You always have to think about where that information is coming from and how reliable it might be. I think
exactly.
That's a good point. And how about some of those orphaned photographs? Do you work with those that much? Are there things that folks can do once they have lost that contextual information?
Sure. I mean, let's take the orphan photos first, because the sort of typical definition of an orphan photo is one that's been abandoned by family in a antique shop or tag sale, or you find them by the roadside almost, abandoned by or left behind. Everyone's family has died, and there was no plan to who was going to get the family photos. So let's take those first. If you go to a show and you buy a photograph and it has a person's name on the back, what are you going to do with that image? A lot of genealogists actually spend time researching that person and try to reconnect family with their missing photo heritage. I put a challenge up about 8 years ago of a little boy I found at a photo show, and he had a name on the back, and I did all the research, and the really sad thing about the photograph is the man had died in the 1980s. And so this was a photograph of him as a baby, about 1900, and there was no family that I could find to take the photograph back. So he sits out there on the web as a challenge for someone to come forward. If you have an unidentified photograph in your family collection, and you want to know more about the picture, you have to look at it in terms of, well, what do you know about your family history? And then you place that photograph in a historical context for that family history. You learn about the people, what they're wearing, the type of photograph, and you research all those details, and you research those people to find out if this person is possibly, as I mentioned before, Great Aunt Mabel. And it does work. And then if you are not able to verify that this might be a relative of yours, or you can't figure out anything at all about the picture, there are websites that are known as reunion websites, and there are two major ones. One is called deadfred.com, and everybody laughs when you say Dead Fred, but it is the name of the site, and it's memorable, and it's free, and you can upload your photos, and people can look at them, and reunions happen. About 5,000 people a week go on Dead Fred, and I get emails for every reunion that happens. I'm on sort of an automatic mailing list for that site. Then there's another website called ancientfaces.com, which is another one of those reunion sites where people post photographs. But on Ancient Faces, it has sort of a twist because you can also post family recipes, which is kind of cool. And these sites get a lot of traffic. People are always looking for those missing photographs that they had heard about were in the family, but, what happened to them? Who inherited them? And I just recently, with the anniversary of the Civil War coming up next week, read a very interesting sentence written by a photo historian who claimed that every Civil War soldier had had a photograph taken. Now, I think that's a little bit of a brag, but I think at some point most Civil War soldiers had their picture taken. And that makes you think, well, if my ancestor fought in the Civil War, why don't I have a photograph of him? And then you start to think, well, where can I find those photographs? And, you know, Dead Fred and Ancient Faces are certainly one place to start. If you're looking for a family photograph that you can't find, you can go to message boards on genealogy websites like rootsweb.com. That's rootsweb.com. There are free message boards, and you can say, I'm related to so-and-so. He lived during this period. He lived in this town, and I'm really hoping someone out there might have a photograph of him. The Library of Congress website at www.loc.gov is a wonderful resource for photographs of all sorts, and they've just posted an enormous digital archive of Civil War images. So the pictures are out there. It's just a matter of finding them and hoping they haven't been destroyed.
Right. And I think that we're on the front edge of major digitization of a lot of images, as well as wonderful metadata, being able to find this information a little bit more. And I think we're still probably about 10 years out before the everyday person will catch that message, that they're able to preserve their family photographs and artifacts for at least the information about them. But I think more and more people are becoming more and more aware of the resources that are available to them out there.
Yes, I think that's true. I'm busier than ever. You know, I have a whole series of books written about identifying photographs in certain time frames or interpreting the evidence in them. And I have a book that's doing quite well called Preserving Your Family Photographs, which advises people on how to take care of the images that they do own.
Right. I've got a copy of that sitting right here next to me as we talk. I think this would be a great point for maybe you to talk about some of your work as an author. What are some of the things that if people buy your book, they'll be able to find out about from the different books?
Well, if they buy Preserving Your Family Photographs, it's almost a step-by-step approach to caring for all the different types of images in your collection, from early daguerreotypes, those shiny silver plates from the 1840s, all the way to, well, I take digital images and I'd like to print them at home. What do I do? How do I do that? That book sort of takes you from the early era all the way to the present.
That's a wonderful thing. I think it's something that folks don't even think about now, is that a lot of our images now only live in electronic form, or they're printed out on paper that might not be suitable 10, 15 years from now.
So. I have a new book called Finding the Civil War in Your Family Album. It really launches next Tuesday for the anniversary, and that's available through my website, which is maureentaylor.com. And it leads you through all the different aspects of photography and family photographs during the 1860s, from what people wore to what types of images were popular to how can I find a picture of my Civil War ancestor. My sort of big title at the moment is a book called The Last Muster, Images of the Revolutionary War Generation, and this took me about 8 years to put together, and I'm working on volume two now. When I first began that project 8 years ago, I imagined I might find 10, 12, 14 pictures, maybe, of people who had fought, who lived during the American Revolution, but lived long enough, meaning after 1839, to have their photograph taken. And in fact, in The Last Muster, there are 70 men and women and immigrants and Quakers and a real cross-section of the American population from during the war years who lived long enough. Now, they're all pretty old in the photographs. I'm not going to lie. They're all 80 to 100 years old or more, but their life stories are fascinating because they're ordinary individuals who lives were changed by a big event.
Right.
Yeah, huge event.
In researching a book like that, were there any big ahas for you, things that maybe you hadn't thought about in doing this type of research, something that you discovered that you didn't think you'd ever find?
Well, you know, it was an exhausting project to work on and expensive as well, but it was remarkable to step outside the published history books and read the pension reports that these men, or pension applications that these men and some women filed, or to research all these different aspects of life during the revolution from the average person's standpoint. But here's some things that sort of stand out. You know, I'm a genealogist, and I deal with birth and death all the time in family records and research. But I was not aware that so many individuals lived past 100 in the 19th century. You know, you sort of brought up and you learn in history class that, you know, we had no antibiotics and there was a lot of disease and basically people didn't live very long. Well, that's not exactly true. There's a lot of people who lived quite a long time. And the other thing that was just completely startling was the age at which some of these individuals claimed service during the revolution. The youngest person who had a story to tell about the revolution and had witnessed a historical event was 5 years old. And he accompanied his father to Fort Ticonderoga and witnessed, I believe it's Ethan Allen and Benedict Arnold, arguing about who was going to enter the fort first to retake it. And as an older man, he traveled about giving lectures about this event. And, you know, there's lots. I mean, I let the people in the book, the photographs speak for themselves. And, you know, your face really is a sort of accumulation of your life. And by the time you're 100, there's a whole story there. And so I tried to let these individuals tell their own story through writings that they might have done or interviews or obituaries written about them. And there's a lot of bragging about every, there's some guys who brag that they met every major Revolutionary War general there was. But if you read between the lines, there's a kernel of truth there. And this little boy tells this story, and you can believe it. It doesn't appear to be that embellished. So perhaps there's some truth there.
Well, and
but 5 years old. Yeah.
That is just amazing to me. And I think that, you know, when they say that the past is a foreign land, I think it's hard for us to realize the lives that people lived and the fact that people now who seem so legendary to us were so approachable. Tourists that would stay with General Washington or President Washington at Mount Vernon just because they made it there and that was part of hospitality at the time. Now, you know, you would never think of just showing up at somebody's house to stay.
Knocking on the door of George Bush's ranch in Texas.
Exactly. And so it really was a different time for people back then and a different world. And the people were expected to do whatever they could at almost any age. So that's really amazing to me.
Yeah.
I was reading on your website that you're working on a follow-up to that book.
I am. The Last Muster was released in June of 2010. And while it took me 8 years to accumulate the photographs for the first volume, the second volume is coming along at a rapid rate because now that the first book is out, people are looking at their family photographs differently. Or they're going to archives, or they're looking through local history books for me, and they're finding more and more images of individuals who lived after 1840, but, you know, actually saw service or were alive during the years of the Revolution. So it's just amazing. I actually got an email this morning from someone. It's almost a weekly occurrence now, so I actually need to spend some time organizing that book.
I think that's one of the reasons I've started this podcast is a way of networking with people because the more that you say that you're interested in a topic or in a research method, the more you become acquainted with people and that might be able to help you out or inform you or that you might be able to help out in return.
So that's right.
I think that that's one of the great things about the type of work that we do is the community of lay researchers that we come in contact with and assist. One of the things I wanted to ask you about was the images that are produced from that very early time, 1840s through right after the Civil War, are really quite remarkable images because of the process, the daguerreotypes, the ambrotypes, even tintypes. How can you talk about those and how they're different from some of the images that came in the years after that, and how people might be able to recognize them?
Well, back when I was sort of a newbie to this business and really knew some things about photo history, this is a long time ago now, this is ancient history in, you know, a person's life, but I had an opportunity to see a daguerreotype. And I write about on my website about how I looked at that image, and it was like falling in love. I'd never seen anything so beautiful. And when you look at a daguerreotype, one that's in good shape, good condition, and it's so shiny and reflective, and if you have to hold it at like a 45-degree angle to really see the image. And at the same time, you're seeing yourself in the picture, so you're like looking back into the past. So it's almost like a romantic feeling there. And the people look so real. They almost look three-dimensional. They look like they could just step right out of the daguerreotype and, you know, say hello to you. So you almost feel like you're looking at living history. When you look at an ambrotype, it's a little different type of image. It's a little flatter looking because it's on glass. And it's basically a negative that's made to look positive when it's backed with something, a dark substance. And then a tintype is actually on iron, not on tin. And they come in all different sizes. Some of them as small as your thumbnail. They're called little thumbnail tintypes or gems. And each one of them is very different. I mean, a tintype is somewhat like, I sort of would think, a contemporary paper print. It looks the same, except it's on iron. But an ambrotype and a daguerreotype are vastly different than anything that we encounter today in our photo albums.
I've looked at those ambrotypes, and they're often have a little, just a hints of color put to them. And the daguerreotypes, where you're holding them, and you literally, in order to see them, you have to engage with them, which is pretty amazing. Can you tell me just maybe one aha moment in your work where you were just thrilled with the outcome of it? Some interesting story in your work.
And that, no, it just happens all the time. I do have a million of them. You know, someone asked me this morning what my favorite photograph of all time was, and I said, you know, I can't tell you that. I have a new favorite every day or every week. But there are wonderful things. A few years ago, I did a short video. I have a little website where I have videos on Vimeo.com, and if you / photo detective, you'll see them. And I wanted to create sort of a themed video for 4th of July. So I wanted to find flags and photographs. And I went on the Library of Congress site, and I looked through all the pictures I've bought over the years. And on the Library of Congress site is this lovely little stereo view, which a stereo view is it's almost like, you know, think of ViewMaster, only 1870s. So it's two images that are nearly identical, but when you look at them through a special viewer, they become 3D. And there was this lovely little girl draped in a flag with a crown on her head, sort of the personification of Columbia. And I thought, gee, what's behind this picture? Well, the more research I did, the deeper the story became. And it turns out she's the photographer's daughter, and he posed lots of townspeople in his pictures. And he's from a little town in New Hampshire. And then I went on to research, you know, her life and what happened to her. And she dies at a young age as a young married woman. Or there was a photograph I worked on a few years ago where the woman is wearing a pin, and it's a rhinestone pin. And the person really wanted to know if I could identify why she was wearing the pin. And I could tell from their hairstyle and the type of photograph and the dresses that they were wearing that this was, you know, the 1880s. And the pin said, Blaine. Well, Blaine was a presidential candidate in the early 1880s. And this woman was showing that she was a Republican by wearing a piece of political memorabilia. And it didn't actually have anything to do with family history other than the fact that it was, you know, didn't have to do with family names in the family. It had to do with her political leanings, which was kind of funny. I've got one more. So more recent one, the if you look at the cover of my new book called Finding the Civil War in Your Family Album, there's a beautiful painted ambrotype on the cover. And it's a young woman in a beautiful 1860s bonnet with a big yellow ribbon under her chin. And she's holding right at the edge of the picture, at the base of the picture, a photograph. So she's brought a photograph into the picture, and it's a Confederate soldier. And the really remarkable thing is, when I first saw this picture, it's an ambrotype. So ambrotypes usually, 99% of the time, have a mat around them, sort of frames the image. And so it blocks out parts of the picture. And when I first saw it, it had the mat in place. And I wanted to do some more research on the photograph, so I asked the owner if they could send me a better scan of it. And they did, and they took the mat off. And underneath the mat was this photograph of a Confederate soldier. So you have this teenage girl on the cover looking very Mona Lisa-like with a very, you know, slight smirk on her face. And she's holding this photograph of a Confederate soldier so that it's covered up by the mat. So it's not like a secret. I love it because I love those sort of hidden pictures that we all find, or somebody takes a part of framed photograph and lo and behold, there's another picture there. Or they take a, you know, great-grandmother's sewing box and there's a picture in there of a man they never saw before, but he's at the bottom of the sewing box and it's not her great-grandfather. It's not her husband. So, you know, there's all kinds of fun things in family photographs. I should mention that I have a free e-newsletter that comes out once a month. If someone goes to my website, maureentaylor.com, and they fill out the thing, they'll get a newsletter from me for free where they learn about videos or tips on how to researching photographs or things that I'm working on and places I'll be speaking and things like that. It's really fun. I love what I do.
That's great. Well, I do have to say that you seem like you're always working on a new project. You've got several books out. You also are, I looked at your website, doing lots of speaking engagements and offering workshops and those sorts of things. So I have a feeling there will be lots of opportunities for folks to come in contact with you and to make connection. If folks want to find out more, you've already given the information, but what's the best way to engage with you?
The very best way is to contact me through my website, which is www.maureentaylor.com, and that's M-A-U-R-E-E-N, Taylor, T-A-Y-L-O-R.com. If they have a photograph they want me to work on, they click that upload the photo link, and it tells them how they can sign up for some personal telephone consultation time talking about their pictures. If they want me to come and speak in their area, they click on the Contact Maureen link. It's a brave new world with all this internet stuff, and there's more ways to do outreach. So I'm doing some webinars, and I'm doing some teleseminars starting in May. So if you got a question, ask away. You're always looking for content.
Thanks for being a part of the Artist and Ancestor podcast.
Thank you so much for having me on the show.
Well, thanks.
You've been listening to Artists and Ancestors with music by Martin Simpson and hosted by me, John Kay. I'd love to hear from the listeners out there to give me some ideas for future podcasts or folks to feature on the show. Let me know that you're listening out there. And until the next episode, keep up your research of the creative lives of people from the past.